Welcome to the Minivate Gang Podcast, episode 244. I am Steve Borsch, and I'm on with Tim Elliott.
And we're singing the blues down here in Lakeville.
And Graham Thickens.
Love that Hammond organ, baby.
Hey. And then Our buddy Phil is off this week. And who knows what we're going to be able to pull together in this month. But, you know what's interesting? I don't know if you guys are experiencing this, but boy, a lot of companies are pinging us about stuff that they want us to propose and all of that for next year. And it's looking pretty positive. Like 2014 is going to be a year that is finally we're going to see some business. Things are moving back. So that's good.
Yeah. So what are they proposing? What do you, business are you talking? Or?
Yeah. Business, cool. But also I was watching Charlie Rose with the economists that have been, he's the Harvard guy. He was Obama's economist, the first one. Anyway, but they were talking about, I'll find his name here, but they were talking about the things that are going to happen in 2014 based on just moves that are happening right now in the economy. And so there was some pretty positive spin going on there. And of course, he's got no axe to grind now. He's not with the administration. So he doesn't have to defend anything or any policies or any of that. But
if you believe that, I've got a couple of bridges to sell you. Out east.
Tim, you are so pessimistic.
Skeptical. he's the journalistic skeptic.
He is.
Once you're in the administration, you're always in the administration.
Think so?
You know? He's on Team Obama the whole way. He's committed.
Yeah. Probably.
Kind of like the Star Tribune, you know, they just won't get off the cheerleading thing, you know? The headlines scream, oh, the economy's coming back, you know.
Contact with the Pioneer Press to print their paper, so they're pumped.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, now they can underwrite some of their costs. Yeah,
and the pressman has a hotline right to the editor when he sees that St. Paul paper, and hey, look what they're covering here.
That's right.
You might want to get your reporters on this.
So, did you go down to the Coco Uptown thing? I noticed the picture here where they've got directions on how to get into the building below CVS, and there doesn't seem to be any snow in that photo.
Well, there was, but we slipped and slid down the ramp there. Actually, it wasn't too bad. We went in through the back, and they have a really nice room back there for events that easily held a crowd of, it had to be more than 150.
Really?
And, you know, they kind of have that they do have that big glass overhead door, garage door, that they can close to shut off that back area from the rest of the co-working space. And it worked out really nicely. It was a very good event with Kyle and Don, the founders of Coco, doing their thing on how you can begin doing the work of your dreams. And it was an awesome workshop kind of a thing, where everybody participated and did their own exercises on what they could do to help realize how they could, you know, do more meaningful work in their lives. It was a really good participatory session. Mm. And then they used the opportunity to announce their Coco Jump School, which is in the show notes here now, cocojumpschool.com. These guys just keep knocking it out of the park. I mean, Coco is so much more than just a co-working space. I mean, these guys have had an interest in, you know, training and self-help kind of sessions. And, you know, they did some things with the Stanford D School, and and the whole Google for Entrepreneurs thing is a lot of that is about training and so forth. But this is their own initiative. And yesterday they announced it and showed the site, and it's up and running, and you can sign up for it. It's great.
Well, what's interesting is I've never really talked to Kyle much about this, but I have with Don. And it's clear that real early on, you know, they were trying to figure out what was happening in co-working and directionally what was happening with free agency and all that, mm-hmm. and really trying to figure out where the model should be and was going to be and what was happening with demographic trends and everything else. And this is a kind of a natural extension of that, isn't it?
Oh, it is. I mean, they've been all about the future of work. And you know, I had the good fortune to meet one of their kind of silent partners, a guy named Jeff Hegard. Do you happen to know him, Steve?
Yeah, I met Jeff. Sure.
Yeah, he works with Haberman and Associates.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And he's
nice
got
guy.
He is. And he's got the same kind of vision, obviously, as they do about this whole COCO initiative, overall. And, you know, these guys have, like I say, it's a lot more than just a real estate play where you, you know, lease a seat in a co-working space. So, you know, my hats go off to them again. It was an awesome event. Michael Roventine continues to pull off, you know, excellent events and keep serving up that bacon and bagels, baby. Oh, man,
that's all that matters.
The
thing is, though, is that, you know, the photo in the header on Social Media Breakfast, every single time I go to the site, I can't help myself. I'm nervous that there's bacon grease dripping on that phone.
Like the coffee stains underneath of it.
Yeah, I know it's a 3GS, but, you know, still.
But, you know, that was number 61 consecutive monthly meetings of Social Media Breakfast. Minnesota can be proud. You know, I don't think anybody else in any area of the country has done it as long and as big as Minnesota has,
mm-hmm.
which leads us into the Minnesota news, of which there is a ton.
There is a ton. Well, the first one was Julio's article on with the Weber Shandwick folks doing that WordPress plugin, converting Google Glass into a blogging tool. And,
makes you wonder, people are going to be doing that. Just think of the privacy concerns about, you know, posting videos and pictures and whatever, just from people walking around. I mean, this makes it very, very easy to do that.
Well, and I don't know if you guys ever have, but I've dealt with it before where we've had to blur faces in photos in publications, you know, when we've created these trend albums or even in our newsletter where we've done photos in a trade show situation, then unless you have a model release, you can get sued.
Yep.
And so I really wonder how long it's going to take before something like that happens, especially to your point, Tim, about, geez, if I can auto post something, you know, Tim is drunk drinking out of the keg again. And I can post that on Tumblr on my WordPress blog. And, now your boss sees it and away you go, right?
That's right. It auto-posts to your Twitter and it's all over the place.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and how about, you know, like live streaming to your YouTube channel from your Google Glass? Can't you do that? If you have 100 subscribers to your YouTube channel, you can live stream.
Yeah, yep. They just announced that yesterday. That's right.
Yeah, I'm still trying to get up to 100 so I can live stream. But not with Google Glass.
Well, now they actually opened that up. Google announced yesterday. I'll put a link in the show notes that anybody with an account that's verified and is in good standing can go ahead and stream through YouTube.
What kind of an account that's verified? You mean a Google Plus or what kind of account or a YouTube account?
Account.
Which is kind of one and the same now, isn't it? Don't you use the same password for
But you still
Google
need
Plus
but you still need to have the
a YouTube
verified
account.
Yeah, you got to have that verified, and there's a process at YouTube to do that. But
yeah, I should do that. Then I won't have to keep spamming my friends trying to get them to subscribe to my YouTube channel so I can get up to 100.
Right. Well, but you know the one thing that I look at too is I don't know how you guys feel about this, but. You know, Graham, you do a lot of interviews when you go to these various events.
Yeah, I try to. That's where I thought the live streaming could be kind of
fun. Live streaming could be fun. And also, but imagine if you had a pair of Google glasses and you were able to interview somebody and post the thing virtually immediately.
Yeah. Maybe I'm going to have to get me a pair of those, you know. You maybe Scoble can get me a deal.
Yeah, right.
Just wait until next year. They'll be cheaper then. But
oh, yeah. Aren't there copies coming out, too? I mean, knockoffs? I've read about one that was like half the price or something.
Yeah. I don't think any of those are going to be that great, though. I'm kind of, I don't know. I'm not that up on Google Glass. It seems like a really expensive kind of thing, and I know they're going to bring the price down, but even if it was, you know, $200 or $300, I don't know, it's kind of
deal. Well, I might get it if it was that cheap, but if it was $700 or $800, I probably won't. But aren't they trying to put them into prescription glasses? I seemed like I read something like that too. Now that's when I might make a move, but you know, get my Roy Orbison kind of thing on, you know.
Well, so the one thing that I really want, though, and on all seriousness, is I want a pair of glasses like that and a data connection that doesn't cost me $1 million when I travel and be able to do augmented reality. So if I'm standing in a location, you know, in the middle of Berlin, I can maybe do an overlay of video or images or have Google Glass show me things that are, historical in that specific spot. So, you sort of have this context aware information coming all the time if you choose to have it.
Is there really a lot of benefit for that versus just having it on your smartphone?
That's a great point. I mean, it's probably easier.
I guess it would be slightly easier, but I'd still think that if you had that on your smartphone, that would be really valuable. That would be. But one application I haven't seen a lot of development on is journalists having these things. I think it would be great.
Oh, yeah. Which you're Julio right. talked about in his piece, right? He's kind of intrigued about, he says he's riveted by Google Glass and how it can be used for press coverage.
Right.
Yeah.
So I don't know if he means PR people or journalists there, but I think he means journalists.
Yeah.
Well, I know that there are, I mean, I'm sure you guys have seen these as well, but there are apps that are, you know, like there's one called Cop Recorder, and you can put your phone with the camera showing and just push a button and it starts recording. And it'll record as long as you want it to. And so there's a lot of that, but imagine with Google Glass that everything you're looking at, can be recorded, especially live over YouTube. I mean,
that's scary. Yeah. Who's going to monitor all the porno kind of stuff that could happen there?
I'll take care of that.
You want that job?
No.
Sign me up, baby. I was going to say, does YouTube have like a whole building of people that are sitting there, you know, approving videos?
Nah, it's all algorithm based.
You think so?
They have people looking at the ones that the computer like sends them, though, you know?
Well, so what they do is they figure out what music is being played is they actually have the waveforms laid out and analyzed. And so they look at the waveform itself, and they have different points on the waveform, and they turn that into a digital snapshot, if you will, of the waveform. And that's how they can search through all the waveforms to find music that's problematic. It's copyrighted.
Yeah, they can tell the difference between Nine Inch Nails and Bob Dylan or whatever.
Right. Yeah.
Interesting.
So our buddies at NativeX are expanding a little bit. They're doing a partnership with Sega of America and Sega of Europe for their ad technology.
That's a biggie.
That is a biggie.
Well, it could be. It's just for one game right now.
Oh,
it is. Okay. I thought it was for the platform.
Sonic Dash.
Okay.
And, you know, I'm sure if it's successful, they'll expand it to their other titles.
Yep.
Yeah, I'm sure those guys are anxious to prove themselves on that one game so they can, you know, expand that partnership.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see where this all ends up. And also how they can play, and we'll talk about iBeacon in a little bit, but with what's happening with the contextual, potentially contextual based ads, you know, like the Minority Report thing where you're walking by and the ads call out your name. Hey, Graham, here's a,
you know, underwear's on sale.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the black panties that you sneak, they're available for.
Yeah. That I've seen on those YouTube live streams.
That's right. And another company, Network Instruments, who put this in the show notes? Because I don't know these guys.
I thought that Graham might, but.
I was shocked. No, I didn't. I was shocked to read that. It's like, I thought I knew every single $200 million company in Minnetonka. Well, they're not $200 million. They're $40 or $50 million. But they got acquired for $200 by JDSU.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't spend a lot of time on network plumbing companies, really. That bores me to tears. It makes me break down and cry.
I'm the same. I'm exactly the same way. Well, so yeah. These guys are a supply chain company.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are a lot of supply chain companies that do even stuff like RFID that are local here that are, you know, $5, $10, $15 million companies. And it's like, you know, whatever. I mean, you know, somebody, you walk into a restaurant, you see a bunch of glasses with water in them on the table, right? Well, somebody somewhere had to sell those glasses. But, you know, whether or not that's a business you want to be in is another story.
Yeah.
But that was a big chunk of dough.
Well, yeah, and congratulations to the founders, because I'm sure, and the investors, I'm sure it was a nice payday, which brings up the other little story I stuck in the show notes about Dell announcing the latest on their cloud strategy, and that's all revolves around Instratus of Minneapolis.
I did not see this. Oh.
Which they acquired back in May, a company near and dear to my heart. George Reese, the CTO, being a good friend and former client, and David Bagley, the CEO. Yeah, they're sitting in the catbird seat on that whole Dell cloud strategy. So kudos to them as well. And they're still in Minnesota. They aren't moving to Austin.
That's good.
So, yeah, they're still down at 12th and Marquette, as far as I know.
Well, I think we're going to see a lot out of Dell. But we're not going to know about it because they're not public anymore.
Right.
And they're going to do a lot. You know, the host that I'm at, you know, the Bluehost dedicated servers are all Dell blades.
Oh, yeah.
And so one rack, I think, has 10 blades in it. And they're, you know, essentially a computer on a card. And it's all Dell. And, you know, they don't talk about that stuff. They don't make a big deal about it. But becoming ubiquitous.
Yeah, the VentureBeat story goes into some of that detail about, you know, the advantage of not being a public company anymore and having to be beholden to Wall Street every quarter. But it also quotes the head of Dell's cloud business, who's also a George. I forget his last name now. But they are still growing their hardware business, but they're much, much more about software now. And that's growing a lot more than the hardware side. So it's a good story that's in the show notes.
Yeah, I'm glad you saw that. That is a good one.
Yeah.
Huh.
And then speaking of other Minnesota news, the nerdery. My friend Tom O'Neill got a promotion.
Oh, you know him? Okay.
Oh yeah, Tom's a great guy. He's the guy that I first met from the nerdery way back when it was still called Sierra Bravo. And he was like employee number one, I think. He wasn't one of the original founders, but he was their VP of software development for many, many years now. And I think I heard he got shipped off to set up their Chicago office for a while. But I believe he must be back home in the Twin Cities now, having been promoted. I didn't read the whole story, but the link is to their blog post on him being named president.
Well, that's good. And of course, for those that are listening that may not have known or to recall about one of the founders, Luke Buckland, he and his boys died in that plane crash and in Wyoming when they were, I think they were hunting or something, but at any rate,
they were vacationing at Jackson Hole.
That's right. That's right. And yeah. So, yesterday or the day before yesterday, it came out that the family had settled a lawsuit and, it contended that the, that air traffic control played a role in the accident because they actually, now it's always up to the pilot. I mean, the pilot is that that's the pilot has to make the decision whether or not they, that he or she can trust the advice that's been given, but that the, flight control had basically given him the pathway through the mountains and there's no way that his plane could have reached the altitude necessary to clear. And so there was, some fairly, you know, good chunk of blame that went to air traffic control.
Yep.
So anyway, just thought I'd throw that in because it's, you know, they haven't had a president at the nerdery since that happened. And so,
well, yeah, they kind of had the other two or three, co-founders were sort of jointly running it.
Right.
But, one of them, Mike, I'm blanking on his last name now, did, I believe, take the CEO title. Yeah. Mike Durheim. Yeah. I spoke with him at the web overnight website challenge. Yeah. He had finally taken the CEO title, but for a while there, they kind of ran it as a triumvirate after Luke's untimely death.
Mm-hmm.
It's a going operation. I'll tell you, it's, still going strong in, Minneapolis, Chicago, and Kansas City, at least.
Yeah.
Everything I hear.
Well, you know, it really matters when you have people that really, really understand what's going on in the marketplace. I mean, Tim, you know, with doing development, that the more that you know about the platform and the software, I'm talking specifically about WordPress, obviously, the more that you know, the more able you are to properly guide and advise your clients toward a successful use and strategy. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, ooh.
But these guys at the nerdery, they're expert in just about every platform. So
yeah, I was just going to say, not only that,
like not only do they drill down on specific ones, but like figure out which is the best one for the project, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So
you're over there a lot more than we are probably because they hold the, is it weekly or monthly WordPress meetings there?
They're monthly. Although this month, I think it falls on Christmas or the day after Christmas. So they're canceled this month, but, most of the month it's over at the nerdery. Mm-hmm. And they've sponsored that for, I don't know, 5-6 years, quite a while.
Yeah. Actually.
Yep. They're pretty active community participants in a lot of, tech user groups or meetups or, you know, and they sponsor various things. They've been a sponsor of the mini demo mini bar, I'm sure, too, over the years.
Yeah, for a long time. Well, you know, it's also a win-win because the more you can get a pool of people who understand what's going on and are interested and are engaged, A, you could find more employees. B, your clients are going to be smarter because the people that work there are smarter. So there's a lot of win-win there, but hey, who originally put, do you guys remember, that Qbox, that Kickstarter campaign, who originally put that up? Cause was that you, Tim?
Yeah. Months ago when they first, they first came out. But so when I saw the story this week that they had canceled the Kickstarter, I wanted to stick that in as kind of a follow-up.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's weird. What do you think is behind that? The product wasn't ready or they're having difficulties?
They got $40,000 of a $100,000 goal, and I think they were, less than a week away?
Oh, they saw they weren't going to hit their goal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So instead, they said, you can't fire me. I quit.
Right. That's right.
Exactly.
Well, I thought the most interesting thing out of this article was the last paragraph According to a recent University of Toronto study of crowdfunding in the U.S., Minnesota ranked third behind New York and California for the most Kickstarter-funded tech startups.
Wow.
That was pretty cool.
Yeah, I didn't think there was that high of a quantity of them. There's some notable ones, SmartThings being at the top of the list.
Yep, Spark.
I didn't think there were all that many that got funding. I'd like to see that list sometime. Maybe that Toronto study lists them.
Well, but you have to also realize that there are projects on here that on Kickstarter that are films and books and games and all kinds of stuff.
But what you just read said tech startups. And
yeah, you're right.
That's different. You know, yeah, there have been a lot of artsy projects, I suppose. But that surprises me because I wasn't aware of all that many. I'm aware, well, and Spark being the other very successful one behind SmartThings as far as dollars. What were they, 500 and some K in their last go round? But I've known several that haven't hit the number because they were too greedy and set their goals too high. And if you don't reach your goal, you get zip on Kickstarter. So the smart play is to set the goal really low.
Yeah.
You know, which these guys didn't. And now it sounds like they're trying to do a little face saving.
Well, what was amazing to me was the Kickstarter campaign for the Skype phone for seniors, and the guy wanted $250,000 to build this thing, and I looked at it and went, wait a minute, you can just buy a tablet and put put the Skype app on there, so for $300 you can have a, you know, it's like, well, I'm not so sure that was, of course, it died a rapid death on Kickstarter. So, cause the market said, nah, we're not funding that.
Yeah. There's some really stupid stuff, ideas that get put up there, you know, and people get greedy with the money, you know, but like Spark did after they failed their first time around, they were trying to raise 250K, I think somewhere in that neighborhood, and they got like 125. They went back to the drawing board, kind of pivoted the product a little bit, came back, set a new project with a goal of like 10,000 or something, immediately blew by it in about, 3 minutes or something. Yep. and then went to the moon with it, you know, because they pumped it up, you know, hyped it up on social media and every other which way, and got the viral thing going. And, you know, and all of a sudden a month later, they're at 500 and some K, I think it was. I ran into them at Coco Uptown. You know, they moved from Grain Exchange to Uptown.
Yeah, yeah.
And I talked with Steph, and they've got something like 10 people now. They've got somebody in China and somebody somewhere else, and they're just moving right along.
Yeah, I think the China person is, working with companies over there for chips and boards and so forth.
Yep. So they were part of that Hackcelerator program, which is a tech startup accelerator for hardware that was based in Shenzhen, I think.
Okay.
So that's where they got their real good start.
Yep. Well, Tim.
Best Buy.
Oh my gosh. You got a lot of stuff on here, and they're really moving forward, aren't they?
Well, there was a nice piece in the New York Times. It's a long piece. And what's good about it is it kind of tells a story of, you know, how Best Buy has come back and why they're successful. And, you know, has a little anecdote that the author was talking about buying a TV and how great the experience was and how basically, you know, he didn't really have to comparison shop because he got the best deal at Best Buy, strangely enough. So, you know, Hubert Joly is really, you know, doing what we said that they needed to do back 2-3 years ago, which double down on the promise of Best Buy that when I go into that store, I'm not only going to be treated well and have good service, which they've seemed to have improved, but I'm going to get the best deal. And sometimes you have to work at it. Like you have to bring in the comparison to get the price, but you know, most times they've got pretty competitive pricing. So I think that's a great story. And then the other stories that basically are saying that this holiday season electronics is really the big runner. Also helps Best Buy.
Yeah, yes. It sure does.
Yeah, it's quite a story.
Well, just about everybody that I'm connected to on Facebook, family and a bunch of friends, people are talking about tablets. I mean, that's what seems to be the, you know, the gift du jour for this holiday season. Yep. And so I think we're going to see a lot of activity there, but it's not just that. It's really everything electronics. I mean, people are buying
a lot of TVs were sold this Black Friday, you know, and they expanded it out. So I was going to wait in line and go to Walmart or Best Buy and get a TV, but it ended up that Samsung had a deal that started the weekend before Black Friday. So I got the Black Friday price on like Sunday, I think, at Costco. Hmm. And, you know, I'm very happy with it. We've had Samsung flat panel TVs for years. So it was replacing an older one and works great. So very happy. Got the price. Didn't have to wait in line. Didn't have to do really anything because I had a huge stack of them when I went into Costco to pick it up the Sunday before Black Friday. So,
wow.
So retailers are getting more sophisticated on how they're trying to push through the products through the through the supply chain this year because they have a week less of shopping time before Christmas. Mm. So they've been sort of jumping the gun, and I know that people hated that open on Thanksgiving deal, but that actually helped a lot of retailers that were open on Thanksgiving to sell more than they would have normally.
Yep. Yeah. They needed it.
I'm sure we're going to see that next time.
Yep.
Oh yeah. Yep. Well, good for Best Buy. And then they have to fight that goofy lawsuit against this Ohio guy. What the heck?
Yeah.
They had to launch threaten a lawsuit against the guy.
I mean, the Affordable Geek Squad.
I'm surprised that they haven't come down in the sky before now, you know?
They gave him time. They said, take it down, dude. You know, let's just get this over with. And he defied him, and he thumbed his nose at him. The guy sounds like a real strange case.
Well, and then his site now is all about censored by Best Buy, Geek Squad, and corporate America. You know, he's got a big splash screen up here and stuff. And, you know, it's clearly the domain name denigrates the Geek Squad.
The brand.
I mean, it's the affordable. Yeah. It's like saying, it's like having a domain that, you know, Dell computers that actually work.com, you know, and expecting that you're going to be able to defend that against the Dell brand. And it's just like, I mean, come on, seriously. And then I went to the Wayback Machine. I'll put a link in the show notes so you can see what the site did look like. And then Tim, you found something else. That he has.
Yeah, his current site. So it's at affordablerememotegeek.com. And it's really bad. So what's funny is that when you go to the Wayback Machine, his older site, the one that is now censored, actually looked, I mean, it was not great, but it looked better than this thing. I mean, this is embarrassing. If you say, hey, I'll help you build your website. I mean, I'm sorry, I'm not buying.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, he is a 501c3 nonprofit, though. So,
he's trying to claim like he's doing a societal, good deed here by offering service even for free to a lot of people. You know.
Well, this would be a question for Robert Stevens, and if he were on, I'm sure that he might say, "Hey, I called this guy and said, dude, stop this," you know, and the guy's not. Not complying, you know, but
yeah,
this
well,
would be
I
the kind of, he would probably call up man to man and say, look, I started this thing with nothing. And, you know, I appreciate what you're trying to do, but Geek Squad is my brand, you know?
It's like, dude, if you're trying to provide free service to help people, that's a laudable goal, but come up with a name for crying out loud. Why are you leaning on our brand name to do this?
Because it drives traffic. That's
but you know, there's also, there's a, and I've seen them around the Twin Cities. They're called the Bite Squad.
Oh yeah.
And it's great. They got green cars that are, that have white doors. So they kind of look like a, like a, like a green squad car. And, and I just think, you know, seriously, you guys couldn't come up with a more original name.
Yeah, I'm a bit surprised that, that Best Buy hasn't even tried to go after them, because again, it's causing confusion, or it's people trying to piggyback off of other people's intellectual property.
Yeah.
And it's just not right, you know. I mean, why couldn't this guy use like Good Geek or something, or Geekworks or something, you know? I mean, they'd have probably let him get away with that.
Yeah.
But when he puts Geek Squad in his name, come on.
Yeah.
It's gonna work.
Yeah, he was just asking for it. So,
and then he goes and kind of thumbs his nose at him by saying, let him try to get 200,000 out of me. I don't have it.
<You know? laughs> No, I've got a good domain for him to get. It's iBeacon Geek. I'm sure there'll be no problem with that.
Yeah, right. Right.
iBeacon Squad.
Oh, God. Well, we have talked about iBeacon a little bit, and it seems to be a lot of people are talking about it, aren't they?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's the big, it's the topic du jour on all the tech podcasts, that's for sure.
There you go. And for those that don't know what iBeacon is essentially a device that can be placed in a retail location. Retail is the primary use case. And when you walk by with your phone, your phone communicates with the iBeacon, and the iBeacon can send you notifications and interact with apps and so on.
Right. So, but even before the retail thing, which is an obvious application of this, they were doing some work with Major League Baseball. And at the very end of the season, I think it was the New York Mets had their stadium with hundreds of iBeacons. So that they could provide on-location information for people that were at the games, which is another great kind of thing. And you might think of, you know, like museums and other attractions like that you know, you might want to have specific information about a painting or sculpture or whatever.
Yep.
That, you know, because of the location, the phone would know exactly what you were looking at and then tell you about that particular object. So there's a lot of good applications of the technology. But because it's commerce related and money, a lot of money is involved, retail is the one that you see mostly written up about.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, see, that's why there's, they talk about the 200 million plus iBeacons in the world. They're the phones themselves. And in fact, SmartThings has an option now to register your phone with the Smart Hub so that when you walk in, you can have it set up so the lights turn on and, you know, various other things interact with your phone. So rather than have their presence sensor, you've always got your phone with you.
So, right. And that's the thing Mike Elgin talked about in his Cult of Mac article, where he wants iBeacon in his house. So that's a sort of application, which makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Yeah, it sure does.
You know, talking about iBeacon uses, do you remember me talking about, or maybe I didn't, since I missed the last one or two podcasts, I was a judge at the internal hackathon at Sport Engine, you know, the former TST Media. Mm-hmm. And the winning hacker team, there were eight of them, was the mobile team led by Shivani Khanna, who used to be a W3i NativeX. And they did an iBeacon implementation for their platform. To use, you know, with team sports,
which
is what their platform is all about. Yeah, and that won the most votes and took the prize. So yeah, and you know, there aren't that many companies that have pulled off an iBeacon program of their own yet. I thought I heard one of the big retailers did it though. Was it Macy's or somebody did something?
Macy's. Yep.
Anyway, a local company was playing with it too.
Well, who's the Qualcomm has something, right?
Yeah, called Gimbal. It's a very similar technology using Bluetooth Low Energy.
Okay, so. Is it like a chip, or they're actually devices that you stick on the wall like iBeacon?
I think it's they're just building it into their chipset so that other makers, you know, like Samsung and others that use their chipset for their mobile phones can build in iBeacon-like functionality. So Bluetooth Low Energy is a standard like Bluetooth, you know, regular Bluetooth is. And so it's not an Apple-specific kind of thing, but iBeacon itself, the trademark and their implementation of Bluetooth Low Energy is Apple-specific. So the problem that a lot of people are seeing with iBeacon is that it's only an iOS kind of a thing. So looking at Gimbal and I assume there'll be others that'll be out there will kind of spread this whole thing to more people because, you know, half the market or more is Android or Windows phones. So there's got to be someone that plays there as well.
Right. And regardless of which platform you're fully invested in, at the end of the day, if you're running a business, you don't want to have to do things twice. So I'll have an iBeacon and I'll have a Qualcomm gimbal. All I care about is everybody walking in. I don't care what phone they've got in their pocket. I want to be able to connect with them.
Well, PayPal has a Bluetooth Low Energy offering as well for merchants that they're selling. But it's specifically for checkout. So it's using the same kind of technology.
Okay.
Works across platforms to do checkout for small businesses.
Which puts a further knife into NFC.
Yeah, I think I think NFC's dead.
Yeah, kiss that, stick a fork in it, you know.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't write it off just yet because NFC has better security, as Steve will probably point out, than Bluetooth Low Energy because you have to be very close to an NFC tag to actually activate it. You sort of have to touch it. So Bluetooth Low Energy, you walk into an area and it knows you're there if your Bluetooth is on. If I'm going up to something that has an NFC tag, I have to specifically touch the tag with my phone for it to work.
You know what's really holding NFC back, though, is that what's really killing it is the retailers have to buy expensive new equipment and they're just not going to do it in mass. You know, that's what's really killing it. Money, money, money.
For a checkout, but the actual tags themselves are very inexpensive. They're cheaper than what iBeacon is, which is also inexpensive. They're talking about like $1 a thing, and NFC tags are much less than that.
Yeah, but without checkout, how is it going to ever happen? Without widespread checkout, you know?
No, I agree with you. I don't think that NFC is going to make it, but I think it's still viable for some applications, particularly where privacy is concerned.
It's the old Betamax VHS thing all over again, maybe, huh?
It's like, more like Blu-ray and HD DVD.
Yeah.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens because the, the stakes are pretty high relative to finding ways to connect with all these incredible computers we have in our pockets and purses. I think it's going to move forward pretty quickly. And what is the range of Bluetooth LE? Is it, I've read 100 meters, and that's just insane because I thought it was 10 meters. It was 30 feet. Or is it 30 meters?
I think it's 30. I think Bluetooth 3.0 is 30 meters, I believe.
Okay.
Because I have a lot of Bluetooth devices and I can go throughout my house.
Same.
And they'll work, you know?
Yep.
So I think, and that's further than 30 feet, you know, because I'll be on the first floor and I'll have a speaker going and I'll come down to the basement and it'll still be working.
But is LE more than that or not? The new,
I think it's about the same. I want to say,
okay,
but it uses a lot of power than traditional Bluetooth has in the past.
Well, that's its big feature, is that it can be running and you don't have to worry about it sucking the battery dry.
No,
Yeah. So that's the biggie. But, yeah, I'm actually looking all over the place now for range, and it's not obvious. So I'll find something and we'll stick it in the show notes in terms of the range. So people can know what that is. But clearly Bluetooth is pretty great. Hey, you know what is one downside? I'll just tell you, not that anyone cares. And yes, I know I should not have video running on my phone when I'm in the car. But if I'm streaming audio through the Bluetooth in my Prius, it sounds great because it's buffered, right? But if I'm playing video, the audio is buffered, not the video, and so it's out of sync.
It's a real first world problem.
It is a real, yes. But I thought that was kind of interesting, and so it's like, oh, bummer, I can't watch. I can't even glance down from time to time if they're saying, hey, look at this. All I have to do is listen and imagine. So
yeah, you should only listen. You shouldn't be watching video while you're driving.
Yeah, but I can drive with my knees. So texting is not a problem. No, I never do that. Actually, that's one of the things that I love about voice recognition is being able to just lift the phone up and talk into it. And have it search and put in addresses in the maps and all that.
Hey, fun fact, and also sort of a segue into the next story, is that Bluetooth LE was originally introduced by Nokia in 2006.
Really? I did not know that.
Yeah, they called it Wibri.
Huh.
And then it was merged into the Bluetooth standard in 2010.
Interesting.
Huh. Yeah.
Yeah, so why are these guys building an Android phone?
Why not?
I know, but I just...
It does seem a little odd, doesn't it? Since they're being acquired by Microsoft.
Uh-huh.
But if you read the story, it's sort of... There is a logic there. And there's also something that they don't really mention in the story, which is that Microsoft gets a royalty on every Android phone that's made because of they own intellectual property.
Yep.
That they claim some ownership of Linux, which Android is based on. So, you know, Microsoft benefits from Samsung selling millions of Android phones. So it's not inconceivable that they would themselves do an Android offering. But what the Nokia version that they're talking about anyway with this this Normandy project that they're working on at Nokia is kind of a, you know, totally Nokia-ized version of Android. So it's like what Amazon has done with the Kindle, with their Fire OS, that they've kind of forked Android. They're using the core of it, but the presentation layer is completely Amazon. So Nokia is doing the same thing. So I could see that maybe for lower end, cheaper phones, it would be better than using Windows Phone.
Well,
they certainly have a lot more apps available.
Yeah. Well, there was a news article that had come out, to your point about the royalties and so forth, that Microsoft is making an astonishing $2 billion per year from Android patent royalties. Oh, my God. Isn't that amazing?
It is. It really is.
So I'll stick a link in the show notes on that one, because that's...
So it doesn't make it crazy that they're continuing to pour money into Surface and Windows Phone. I mean, they're making good money on Android, so might as well experiment.
Sure.
And they're on the third version. So when they get to the third version, it's usually pretty good. So I think next year they might get some market share.
Yeah.
Probably mostly on the bones of BlackBerry, but we'll see. Mm.
Well, so there was a big stink this week about Google with Gmail and how, I don't know if everybody knows this, but if you use MailChimp or Constant Contact or other mail providers, the reason that you get these great reports that shows opens and who clicked on what and so forth is the fact that every one of those emails has unique images in there with an identifying code. And so when the images is shown, then you know specifically who received the email. And so that's pretty cool. Well, Google announced that they were going to be automatically displaying images in email. And the way that they were going to do that was that they were going to cache the image on their proxy servers. And marketers immediately went just wild because it's like, oh my God, now if we send out 1,000 emails or 100,000 emails, the very first one is cached and all the others will use that same image and we won't know. Well, as
one guy opened the mail, every email campaign, one guy opened the mail.
One guy. That's right. One guy clicked on it. What the hell?
Who is that guy?
Yeah, yeah.
Who is that? Yeah.
But it turns out that there's actually, you know, you can do those single pixel GIFs or GIFs, you know, to have the identifier on there, and that can get loaded. So it's not the end of the world for email marketers, but it's going to be interesting to see how everybody reacts. Because I know that we love those reports because MailChimp will tell you who came in from Twitter, you know, who clicked on a link in Twitter and who looked at the email more than once, things of that nature. So it's, you know, it's pretty powerful to see that because you can really see the efficacy of your email campaign, especially if you tie it in with a landing page. Yep. And so you can track your conversions. Then you can really get an idea of what works and what doesn't. So. Yep.
And then you can test those landing pages with tools like Minnesota company leadpages.net, which is becoming a very fast growing company because of their cool technology. Uh-huh. So that's the outfit that got the $5 million Series A month or two ago from Foundry Group. Yeah, leadpages.net. Yeah, landing page tools are big stuff. You know, anything that can automate that so-called A-B testing.
Yep. Yep, absolutely.
Hey, Steve, I think it's time for a security tip.
Really?
I think so.
Steve's security tip of the week.
Oh, it must be time for the security tip of the week, I guess, right?
Yes, it sounds like it. Yes,
in a security tip, because having you say it is—it's. I don't know. This seems weird.
Yeah, I know. Oh well. Hey, feel free.
Record yourself third person all the time, right?
That's right. I always do. Well, so this security tip was sparked by the fact that I was at a bank that shall remain nameless, and there was a Minnetonka squad car and some detectives and what I thought were bank personnel standing at one of three drive-through ATMs on Thursday evening. And so I rolled down my window and talked to one of the cops, and he said, yeah, somebody stuck a skimmer on the ATM. And I thought, okay, this is going to be a perfect, I honestly did. I thought this would be a good security tip of the week.
immediately.
But, yeah.
And
it's because, and I'm going to put some links in the show notes, because what a skimmer is it's literally a device that will be stuck on top of the existing credit card reader. And you'll go up there and you'll put in your debit card or your credit card and put in your PIN. And that's captured then by the device rather than the ATM itself. And there's little keypad replacements that are available. There's ones that have cameras in them. Sometimes the cameras are actually mounted above so they can capture the PIN. And these things are typically a little expensive. And so there's a guy named Brian Krebs on security. He writes, his blog is krebsonsecurity.com. And I'll have a link in here to one of his pages that he writes about this stuff all the time. And he had talked about taking one of these off and putting it in his car. And apparently some guy who had clearly was watching had run over to try to get it back because these things are expensive. and he took off, or maybe it was a woman and took off. I can't remember. But anyway, the point is you've got to watch where you are. And apparently, according to all the articles and the FBI website, the biggest time for skimmers to be placed is on the weekend. because there's fewer bank personnel, especially, you know, if a bank closes at 2 o'clock on Saturday and they don't reopen again until Monday morning, then everybody driving through or walking up to the ATM, is happening when nobody's around, really. And so just be aware, if something looks suspicious, don't use the ATM, just walk away from it. And the other thing, this is happening too with gas pumps.
Oh yeah.
So
if it has a device on it, it will just say, will it like give you a message like it doesn't have money or something? What is the user?
I just don't think it'll work.
I mean, would it be, oh, okay. So you put it in there and of course it asks for your thing and you type it in and hit enter and it doesn't do anything.
Yeah. Well, there are some skimmers that are so good. They're a shell that goes over the top of the current, card reader for the ATM. So when you put your card in, it's actually going all the way into the actual ATM, even though all the stuff is also grabbed by the shell that's sitting over the top of the place where you put the card in. And so they can snag your card number and all the information and your PIN number as though you were, just sticking the thing in the skimmer alone. So
what's to stop these guys from just doing ATMs, just having full fraudulent ATMs out there? Probably they cost a lot of money to do that.
Yeah, they cost a fortune, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, so but I always wonder about some of these off-brand looking ATMs, you know, like when I was in Vegas last January for CES. And, you know, of course, Vegas is going to have great security on all this stuff, I suppose. But some of these aftermarket ATMs, whoa, you know, and they charge you some outrageous fee for using them.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? God, I just hate using those things.
Yep, exactly. Well, and the one thing that most people don't know is even though your debit card is backed by Visa or MasterCard, you know, you'll obviously see something on there. Like I have a Wells Fargo debit card. But if someone, and you're only liable if you report it stolen, you're only liable for $50. But here's the kicker. So let's say that you've got $2,000 in cash in your checking account and somebody uses your debit card to pay for something that's $2,000 and that amount is deducted, then you have to go through the whole process and procedure with the bank to prove that it was fraud. And that can take 2 to 6 months.
Oh my God.
And so that if you need that $2,000 that's in your checking account, well,
forget
tough
it.
Luck. Yeah. You're going to be scrambling. So that's the one downside too about using debit cards all the time is that, yeah, you're protected, but it might take you, weeks or months to actually get that money put back into your account.
Ooh.
Unlike a credit card, which of course it's like, hey, too bad. Just cut it up and, you know, you're liable for $50 and that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I think changing that. I heard they were changing that.
Really?
How so?
That the liability will go up for the user.
Oh, really?
Okay.
Oh.
Huh.
Yeah. They're getting sick of all having to cover all that fraud, huh?
Well, yeah, there's a lot of fraud out there. So.
Oh, God, it's huge, yeah.
They got to control it somehow, I guess. But, yeah, it's not great on the user. Of course, the consumer always has to pay.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, how
there is no free lunch.
Yeah,
there is. I'll say. So what's coming up in the events?
Events.
Looks like the Graham Thickens happy hour routine.
Oh yeah, the happy hour week is coming up Monday night and they're Wednesday night, and they're both at Seven Corners at the Republic. The Mobile Tech Meetup happy hour Monday evening and the Minnesota Search holiday social Wednesday evening. So I don't know if I'll be at both of them, but I was going to hit the Mobile Tech meetup happy hour and have a drink for Phil. Or actually, Phil will probably be there, I think.
I've never been to the Republic.
Yeah, it's kind of a cool little bar a restaurant bar.
Yep. That used to be Sergeant Preston's.
Yes, that's the one.
Boy, I spent a lot of quality time at Sergeant Preston's when I was in my 20s. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, we don't want to talk about some of that.
Oh, those days at the U, oh, my God, they shall remain private.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, there was a guy that used to own, he was the co-owner of Midwest Stereo and Video. If you remember them, they used to compete with Sound of Music that became Best Buy. And his name was Doug Gustner, and he bought into the Sergeant Preston's and owned that for quite a while. Huh. And it just, you know, it just was sort of this place that just kept going, like the Energizer Bunny. You know, they just kept going and making money, and it wasn't too flashy, and it wasn't like the place to go or any of that. But it just, you know, there's just enough activity down there that they were able to make money. So.
Yeah, there's another one over there that I think is still in business under the same name. It's been like 30 years or something. Bullwinkle's, isn't it called?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Goofy
yeah.
thing. That's still there? Yeah,
it is. It's an institution.
It is.
Now, what corner is that on?
It would be...
I've been there a couple of times.
Kitty corner from Sergeant Preston, sort of, or the Republic.
Hey, Rocky, watch me pull a rabbit out of my hat.
Oh. Sorry, I just had to play that.
Bullwinkle and Rocky.
Bullwinkle and Rocky.
One of my favorite cartoons from the 70s.
Yeah.
And one other upcoming event, since Phil is not with us, is Mobile March.
Mobile March. Get your tickets now. Yep, there's a link on there for the tickets. And that's
strange enough, that would be in the month of March.
Yeah, it's crazy how that works that way.
It will be.
It keeps coming back. It's like a springtime kind of a thing. In fact, it's on the vernal equinox this year.
Huh.
I believe.
I did not know that.
March 20th. I think that's the vernal equinox.
Huh.
Mm.
So we'll be partying then.
It'll be extra special.
Yes.
Well,
we'll
still have
3 feet of snow on the ground, but that's beside the point.
God, let's hope not. Please, please don't let it be snowy.
Well, I think that's a wrap, don't you?
I think so.
And we'll see you next week on
the Minivate Gang Podcast.
Hey, guys. Take a great weekend.
Yep, you too.
See ya.
Dude!